Welcome back to the Learn Live Music Podcast. My name is Matt. I'm joined today by my co-founder, Joe Clegg. How's it going, Joe?
Good, thank you.
Well, I want to ask you a question.
Go for it.
What the heck is a live music producer?
What the heck? I thought we'd say something else then.
Yeah, well, I thought we'd keep it we can clean it out, on right? The podcast ratings, you know? People can listen to it in the car with the kids in the back. Well,
that's going to fall foul at some point. Come on. Anyway.
Yeah, well.
Okay, what the is a musical director? Live music producer.
Yes, So those are Freudian slips. So let's talk about that. So to me, music director, how I've always thought about that, even from, you know, playing and all that, is the kind of old school band leader. You know, that's what I think of as a music director. And you've been working as a music director, allegedly, and also a live music producer now. This title's being used. So talk to me about that little Freudian slip, or talk to me about... What are the differences? What does it mean, and where are these terms coming from?
Basically, I have no idea what I'm talking about. No idea what I'm doing. And I'll actually wear that badge quite happily. Reason being is that I never set out to be a musical director or like music producer. I wanted to play my drums. I'm a drummer. I studied drums. I found myself in a position where I was playing for an artist that had a meteoric rise in a major label, the Ellie that went all the way from clubs to arenas. And one of the reasons why I actually got that gig, I hadn't had any notable gigs, sort of like major label type things before, so nobody really knew who I was. When I was asked to audition, I asked them for stems. I said, can you, for this one track in particular, can you send me the individual audio files that make up X, Y, and Z, a track called Starry Eyed, and I wanted to chop out the vocal chops, which were a feature part of that track, and I wanted to sample out the kick and snare and clap. Because I had a Roland SPDS and I had a version of Ableton Live. And when I heard that track, I thought, I actually can envisage how this could be done live. It wasn't for any other reason other than this could be really cool. They sent me the audio files. I figured out how to sample and chop them very crudely, but it worked. And I took from audition, played my drums, and they said, oh, well, just give me a minute. I've got this idea. I've got a laptop. I had a 4U rack with a Behringer DI in it, all the cables, made it as... It's easy for them to go, yeah, sure, I'll give you a minute. Humor me. Plugged it all in, pressed play, and Starry Eyed played, and I played the samples on my pad, had a click track and some backing track, per se, and played it. And I got the gig. I didn't ever think that, oh, yeah, if I do this, I'll become like a musical director, and it'd be great, I'll get paid like £10 more, whatever. I had no idea. Within maybe a month or two, maybe a little bit longer, the first few months of working with Ellie, in the band was myself, Ellie, and her producer, Finn, Starsmith. And that first record of Ellie's was huge all around the world. And then Finn went on to produce lots of huge records, incredibly talented guy. He was playing bass and keys on the first couple of tours that we did. And he realized that, oh, actually, I want to be home making records. I don't want to be doing this. That's just not what I want to do long-term as a session player, of course. And they said, Joe, do you want to just, if I send you all the stems, do you want to just make some tracks? And that became me being the musical director, which was a title that was kind of bestowed upon me. And that's what happened. So I just became that role, but I didn't really know what I was doing. And Ellie exploded in the first year. We played on like SNL and Letterman was still going then. Jules Holland was the first thing that we did. And I was running it all from a laptop, running Ableton. Before, really, we had a new crew come on, a front house engineer, Tim, come on to really help show me what I was doing wrong and help guide me in that role. I was just making up as I went along. And that's kind of what I've been doing ever since. Really, what a musical director is, to me, is the same, I guess, as you said. It's very much somebody who can listen to the music, can notate and direct the playing of those parts to whatever instruments that may be required for that particular performance or that session. Historically, that is someone on stage playing keys or guitar that, I mean, depending on the genre, calling out chord changes or nods and glances, reharms, all this stuff. Again, super genre specific. In classical world or in studio world, that is someone that is stood in front of an orchestra conducting, or someone that is actually scoring parts of strings or charts for the players to sit and play their instrument on session. That's what I thought a musical director was. And it still very much is, absolutely. But that wasn't who I was. That wasn't my background. It's not where I came from. It's not what I was necessarily reaching for the entire time. I went and studied drums at a ACM, Academy of Contemporary Music, outside London. So not necessarily the Royal Academy or jazz at Leeds. That wasn't, just wasn't, I'd even a try to go and study those places. I want to go and learn at ACM and be a drummer. I want to play in arena. That's all I wanted to do. So I'd studied music. I had theoretical knowledge, you know, to pass my tests and, you know, whatever, complete my studies. But I didn't go any deeper than that because I was like, very much, I want to play drums. And I could spend my lifetime trying to be a good drummer. And that was my innate challenge of, I probably will never get to where I'd like to be as a drummer. And then I found myself with hard drive full of mixed stems from Calvin Harris for a track and from Max Martin and from Fraser T. Smith and from Spike Stent is mixed all this stuff. I'm like, what the heck am I doing with all this? How do I choose which parts to play? How should they be played live? What's the technology needed to do that? What are the options for that? There's an easy way, there's a hard way. One way costs a lot of money, one doesn't. Learning about that as well. Learning how do I treat, if I get sent a stem set for a track, Calvin Harris was the first big one that I got. What song? I Need Your Love? Was that? I think it was the track. What the heck? I mean, I'm not going to change the way Calvin Harris clap sounds or his kick sounds because the guy's incredible. And I know nothing about this. I would never try and EQ that. It wasn't until we had a great, our first real engineer, France guy with Elvis, a guy called Rick. And he went, come and listen at front of house in soundcheck. I want you just to play that track. Like, and I hit the clap. I'm like, wow, that's so, it's so harsh and bright. Right. Why haven't you EQ'd that? And let's talk about compression. Let's talk about, here's the track and the stems that have been made to be played on Spotify or Apple Music. This is a PA. And the PA at this level is going to change every night. The room changes every night. So instead of leaving that frequency in the clap, which is bright and pops out of a mix when it's compressed and mastered on its own in isolation, the pre-master stage, it's just mega bright and it's the loudest thing in the PA and it's abrasive. And that's a real simple thing to change. And that blew my mind. The waffle is really getting to the point of live music production. That title arrived, was kind of bestowed upon me when I worked for Mumford & Sons on their Delta World Tour. Because we were talking about exactly what the role is and what they need to help with. Mumford & Sons don't need anybody to tell them what to play. They don't need any chart writing. They didn't need that at all. They made this amazing record with Paul Epworth, which had automated layered drum machines and amazing synths and lots of textures that had done through modular rigs. Just great, great textures. But their question was, well, how do we do that live? What are our options? And that's not musical direction. So what is that? And we talked about it, and it's music production. It's production. It's live music production. And at the time, a friend of mine, I explained that to, said, one person said, oh, it's harsh. They're kind of downgrading you from an MD to a live music producer. What does it even mean? And I thought about it and I went, that is a massive upgrade, because actually, for the first time ever, I feel like there's a term that really clearly states what I personally do or how I personally think about this role that I found myself in. And now that I'm doing that for other people, live music producer resonates more with me, because that's what I do. I'm not writing charts out for people. I've had to do it, and I can do it, and maybe not as well as other people, for sure. Even my friends do it better, and that's absolutely fine. I realized that what I was really good at was, or really actually cared about, was passionate about, was how does something sound? Those lessons that I learned really early on with our front of house engineer, Rick, was actually a track is a track. When you pull it apart and you look at the stems of the multis and you piece that back together for a live performance using the technology that we have, really important fundamentals of EQ and compression, mix techniques, engineering skills. When I started to think about music like that and about the shows that we were doing like that, it really helped me to understand that, oh, the metric that I'm being judged by as a musical director is in the room for the show with the people feeling emotionally connected to this moment of music, the way I felt when I first saw an arena when I was 14, you know, being around 15,000 people joined together in this moment, watching music is just incredible. That's a moment in the room. But now that moment is also on the internet forever. whether it's on a phone. Imagine trying to mix a show for translating on an iPhone recording. That's wild. But it'll be on YouTube. It'll be on a live stream from a festival. All festivals broadcast now the shows in whatever format, whether that's TV or online. The same arrangement of a song would go into a radio show or a promo thing at a TV. You wouldn't have time to re-rehearse it or change the edit. You just go and play it. So understanding the big light bulb moment for me, I've totally gone off topic. The light bulb moment for me around the whole musical director, live music producer role was actually, if I understand how to, from source or from stage, have a balanced sound coming from every instrument, every source that is controllable, so not necessarily mics on drums, but anything that's coming from playback, anything that's MIDI, soft synths, guitars, pedals, anything like that, if I can control or finesse that as a mix so that anything that's been sent to the split that goes to monitors or front of house, any split that's taken to broadcast, each split will hear the same gig. And that's how we start to achieve similar results over a festival season, over a campaign of the show sounded good because we had a great engineer. It sounded good because we had a good team on stage that understood, or Simon on LE understood EQ, I mean, incredible sound designer, and we approached sound design from this perspective of it has to be right from source, same for guitars, same for all the drum samples and all the tracks that then filtered down to monitors and down to front of house. Our engineer on LE, all the way back in 2016 on the headline arena tours, Joe Harling, completely revolutionized again the way I thought about what the role that I fulfilled on a show, because it was more that then was like, oh, well, now we're in arenas and what kind of worked in theatres or in clubs that perhaps you don't get away with as much of that now, particularly in bottom end, particularly in build-up of triggers on bass drums with low end on top of low end on top of low end in a big reverberant arena with long reverb times. Like, why is that bottom end all cluttered and muddy? And Joe really helped me and Simon and the guys at the time understand there were some fundamentals now about simplifying, stripping back, not having all that on track. Do it, have one piano that's the same sound. Have one kick drum that creates a foundation for your show rather than changing kick drum sounds, which is what I was doing, faithfully trying to recreate the record for each track. So when fast forward all of this chat to the Mumford & Sons thing where they said, oh, actually, you're probably a live music producer, which I'd never been called before, never heard of before, it actually made sense to me. I'm like, yeah, that is right. That is what I do. It's the classical musical direction thing is exactly what other people do and exist and is incredibly valid. But my pathway, the shows that I've been a part of, the things that I've helped contribute to positively, hopefully, are all live music production. It's all recreating the record, understanding things like mix, translating mixes across different mediums. The people are engaging with the shows now. So I have no idea. MD, live music producer, I think personally speaking, the live music producer thing makes more sense for me.
Yeah, that's really interesting distinction. So this has come together recently. I know, like, a gig that you've been recently working on, you were telling me how you just felt this was a real sweet spot for this live music production role and for what you could bring to that. So tell us what you've been doing over the last 6 months or so and some of the particular vagaries of that show and what you were able to contribute to it.
Yeah, Bastille is what we're talking about. I got a call from my friend Woody, who's drummer in Bastille in the band, last year maybe, April 2021, saying, oh, have you got like 10 minutes just to talk me through how I would recreate this thing on my SPDSX? I'm like, yeah, of course, mate. That call turned into a Zoom call with the management and the band. What turned into a year later of myself and Simon and my company Art Club Live going in and really consulting on how do we, this new record that you've made, which is fully electronic, how do we recreate and capture every nuance of that and be played live entirely? Which was, I guess, the journey that I've been on as a live music producer, as just somebody that's trying to make the best possible live shows that I can since day one all the way through. It felt like, oh, this is exactly what I do and exactly what I'm into and the right time for that. But then the question was also, well, actually, we start with the infrastructure. We start with how are we going to play this back? We want it to be, want every sampled drum to be played live. So, okay, that means doing this instrument racks, drum racks, and Ableton. Cool, that's straightforward. Well, we want all the keys to be changing, automating, filtering. Like, yeah, it's Ableton, we'll do that separate system. Oh, but we have Harmony Engine, layered, stacked vocal effects. We want that live. I'm like, oh, that's cool. That's different. Well, we have to try combinations of analog sort of hardware and software to try and get to the best sounding version of that, but the most stable, repeatable. Same with synth bass. Same with other SPSs around the stage, lots of stuff going on for the record, but then taking that back across the body of work that Bastille have, which is four albums worth of material, plus a lot of EPs and remixes, a lot of tracks. So it was very much a, hey, Joe, do you want to come and help do the thing that actually you do really well and you've spent the last 15 years kind of getting to the point of knowing how to help shape and deliver that? And the answer was, oh, what great timing, amazing. Yes, let's go and do that. And me and Si and other people that worked for us along the way, helping the sound design and shape, along with their crew and the band, arrived at the Give Me the Future tour, which was all live and sounded like the record. And we rearranged songs with them. And with a great, actually, the creative to that is really cool as well. The record itself, very futuristic. It was a really great experience helping, being a part of constructing how four albums worth of material fit inside the narrative of this futurescape that Dan and the band had created, and how we journeyed in and out of this universe theme and refreshed old songs to live within that, and how that was reflected in technology on stage was just a really great experience.
Yeah, very cool. Is there any like one moment in the show that you're particularly proud of that you could describe, or you could just make a bit more concrete for those who haven't seen it, how you were able to contribute and help with it?
Yeah, there are in that show, there's a whole bunch of moments that I'm really proud of. Me and Simon and Josh Rumble, engineer, we did a week of pre-production here at the studio, actually, and that was exploring. Once we'd made, I guess, 30 or 40 songs playable with the new technology, we'd done that work already with the band. But, well, how do we piece this together? Where's the narrative? What story are we trying to tell? And there wasn't really a narrative. So I kind of spent a few days listening again and reading the lyrics and going, okay, well, we look at the keys and the BPM and we can create an arc for a show like this. We start a certain way, we end a certain way with the singles placed where they need to be. But what are the real moments were? How do you create massive contrast in light and shade? How do you go really big and become really small and vulnerable? And there's a vulnerable moment with a song called No Bad Days, where the song is one of those songs on that record that I think I absolutely love, that I heard Dan play in rehearsals once, or just on the piano, and it's that kind of song, just plays itself. But the production for it on the record is really, really cool. But we wanted to obviously land there. So that's where we'll land with the full band playing it. But how do we get to it? The guys, I think Dan and Charlie, who plays keys and guitar in the band, they did a version for like an MTV Unplugged thing, which was amazing, really stripped back piano arrangement with, I think there was like a whirly in there, acoustic guitar, beautiful version. But that's really cool. And there's a motif that Charlie played in it that both Simon and I were like, we have to include that somewhere. And Simon had, he had like an organelle, a little sampler keyboard with him. And he played, I think we played the riff through lap speakers and he played it back and we recorded it. And he just said, oh, just send that over to me. I think he recorded it on my phone and airdropped it over and just put that on the grid arrangement. And this just lines up. It's amazing. And Si came up with this interlude, overture we called it, which was a moment where Kyle played this beautiful piece with lots of ambient textures and this Charlie motif, which we'd sampled back through an organelle via an iPhone recording, which led into a moment of Dan singing with his Harmony Engine and just Kyle playing piano with a big sort of reverse swell thing that went into full band. It's like a 5-minute arrangement, which in the show, I was really proud of the way it came out. But in terms of the device, the moment in the show is for me a really cool moment.
Yeah, love that. Well, I feel a lot more illuminated on the whole music director, live music producer world. So hopefully some of the listeners do too. So thanks for eavesdropping on our little chat. We'd love you to subscribe because we're just getting going. I'm going to be chatting to some people. Joe's going to be chatting to some people too. And let us know who you want to have on the podcast, and we'll try and make it happen.